Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict greets pilgrims at his Wednesday General Audience and urges them to draw nearer to God through the experience and appreciation of artistic beauty. Recalling the young theologian Ratzinger, one of the founding members of the Ratzinger Summer School recalls his first meeting over 40 years ago with the future Pope, the then young theologian Professor Ratzinger. And Face of a Famine. We speak to two members of the Caritas Confederation who have recently returned from the drought-stricken Horn of Africa region about the plight of the refugees from Somalia and the complex underlying reasons for the ongoing famine. Pope Benedict greeted pilgrims at his Wednesday General Audience, held at his summer residence south of Rome, and urged them to draw nearer to God through the experience and appreciation of artistic beauty. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
On several occasions during the summer period, Pope Benedict XVI has recalled the need for every Christian to find time for God, for prayer, amid the many occupations of our daily lives. This Wednesday, he told the thousands gathered outside the papal residence in Castel Gandolfo that in art, the Lord himself gives us many opportunities to remember him.
Today, we reflect on the need to draw near to God through the experience and appreciation of artistic beauty. Art is capable of making visible our need to go beyond what we see, and it reveals our thirst for infinite beauty for God.
He said there are artistic expressions that are true paths to God, the supreme beauty, such as Gothic cathedrals, Romanesque churches, or even sacred music.
Mi torna qui in mente un concerto di musica di Johann Sebastian Bach a Monaco di Baviera.
In fact, the Pope then shared a personal memory with pilgrims, a concert of music by Johann Sebastian Bach he attended in Munich, directed by Leonard Bernstein. He said, after hearing the last piece of music, one of the cantante, I felt, not by reasoning, but in my heart, that what I had heard had conveyed to me truth, something of the truth of the great composer's faith. And this pressed me to praise and thank the Lord. And beside me was the Lutheran Bishop of Munich, and so spontaneously feeling this, I said to him, you know, it's true, a faith and beauty so strong, irresistibly express the presence and truth of God.
Della verità di Dio.
He then cited Marc Chagall's premise that all painters dipped their paintbrush in the Bible, and how 19th century French diplomat and man of letters Paul Claudel was moved to God after hearing the Magnificat sung one Christmas in the Cathedral of Notre Dame. And Pope Benedict concluded by encouraging pilgrims and tourists alike to safeguard the artistic treasures custodied in cities and towns around the world.
Dear friends, I invite you to be open to beauty and to allow it to move you to prayer and praise of the Lord. May Almighty God bless all of you.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
Castel Gandolfo was also the backdrop for Pope Benedict's annual so-called Summer School, or Schülerkreis, that this year discussed the theme of new evangelization. Those participating in the week-long summer seminar included 40 former theology and philosophy students of the then Professor Joseph Ratzinger. This year, for the first time, the former students were joined for the final days by a number of people who have written their dissertations on the works of Joseph Ratzinger. The Ratzinger Schülerkreis first began in 1977, and one of those original founding members was Father Vincent Toomey, Professor Emeritus of Moral Theology at Maynooth Seminary in Ireland. Father Toomey recalled his first meeting more than 40 years ago with the then Professor Joseph Ratzinger when, as a young missionary priest, he sought to study theology under him.
The reason we're speaking to you today is because you've just spent the last couple of days in Castel Gandolfo as part of the Schülerkreis, or what is known in English as the Papal Summer School. You've been a member of this school for quite a long time. Can you just take us back all those years?
40 years exactly this year.
All those years. The first time you met, came face to face with then Joseph Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict XVI.
Well, I have to go back a year before that because my superiors gave me permission to go to study for a doctorate in Germany. At the time, we had a student hostel in the university city of Münster. My original intention was to actually study under the then unknown Walter Kasper. But a day or two before I left for Germany, I ran into my old professor of fundamental theology, Kevin McNamara, who asked me what I was going to do. And I told him I was going to Munster, but that I would move to Tübingen because Kasper had already moved to Tübingen that year. He said, no, I said, don't go to Tübingen because we had a very promising young theologian, German theologian, here at the Maynooth Summer School last year, that would have been 69, who said he had to leave Tübingen because he couldn't do any real study or work because of the student unrest and because of tensions on the faculty. And he moved to his own home of Bavaria. His name is Joseph Ratzinger, yeah. But he said, anyhow, don't go to Tübingen. Yeah, so I said, okay, I won't go to Tübingen. Went to Munster. Then I sat in on the lectures of Karl Rahner, who at the time was the big figure in theology, and attended his seminar. And within a very short time, I knew I couldn't study under Karl Rahner. So I remember this conversation with Kevin McNamara. And I said, I wonder now, would Joseph Ratzinger, he's not very well known either, thank God. And I had read one of his books, Introduction to Christianity, his classic book, really, in a sense. I wonder, would he accept me? So I wrote to him, and he said, come, we'll have an interview. So I went down in January of 1971. I got a taxi, went off to his private house in the suburbs of Regensburg, Pentling. And he received me. And what struck me immediately was how simple the house was. You know, a new house, but very basic furniture, very simple. And mostly books, of course, around the place, but very neat. And he himself, a very simple man, with wonderfully sparkling eyes and extraordinary ears. Yeah. So he listened very carefully. I spoke, as I normally do, non-stop. He quietly listened, nodded, and was wondering then, would he accept me? And he said, well, what would you like to study? So I had a whole list of things I would like to study. He smiled and said, okay, we'll discuss that later. So that was my first meeting with him, and the rest is history.
So you studied under the then Professor Joseph Ratzinger, but it was a little while later that the actual Schülerkreis came into existence. How was that born?
And well, it was born really in, I think, Munster, even in Tübingen, when he began to receive, to take on a lot of doctoral and postdoctoral students. He also was engaged with the council. He was Paretus, so he was up and down to Rome. He was involved in various commissions. He really had no time to spend much time with his students, so he formed a doctoral colloquium. Now, that's not an unusual thing, but his was unusual because it met regularly. And there the students would discuss their research with him and with others. Yeah. And by the time I came to Regensburg in 71, we had about 30 members of the colloquium.
And where were they drawn
everything.
From?
Were
they
half were German and half from all over the world, yeah? From America, South America, Spain, Italy, Korea, India. So they were from all over. It was 50-50 German, 50-50 international. Yeah.
So he really drew people to him.
He did. He was known at the time for being rather critical of developments after the council. And there were a number of people who were also young people who were also not really impressed with the way things were, the council was being interpreted. And of course his writings were, in Germany his writings were quite well known, really made an impression, especially his book Introduction to Christianity, and abroad as well. It was translated eventually into 20, 30 languages. So he was a man who was marked by a marvellous openness of mind.
A lot of people wouldn't associate that with Pope Benedict now.
Well, I wrote a little book, if I might advertise for it, called Pope Benedict XVI, The Conscience of Our Age. And in it, I compare my time in Munster with Rahner, the theologian at the time, and my experiences in Regensburg with Ratzinger. Rahner was known for his dialogue and talk about openness to the world, etc., etc. But he had become an oracle. He just spoke and spoke and spoke. And we students were totally frustrated. We just couldn't discuss anything with him. He wasn't interested. In Ratzinger, he had had this big seminar, but also this colloquium, but also in his seminars for ordinary students, he had the capacity to create an atmosphere of discussion where everybody felt he could say what he wanted to say, provided he was being honest and could try and substantiate what he said by recourse to scripture, tradition, or whatever it is, you know, philosophy. And Ratzinger has the wonderful capacity to listen to what everybody says. Apart from extraordinary intellect, he also has an extraordinary memory, quite extraordinary. He knew all our names within about a week or two. Normally, a colloquium or a seminar, they had the same structure. Somebody would read a paper, a student, and then the paper would be open for discussion. Half an hour paper, 1 hour discussion. And Ratzinger would allow the discussion simply happen. And then after 20 minutes or so, he would begin to draw the threads together. Then he would say suddenly, Mr. Müller there, he made a point that nobody took up afterwards. And Mr. Müller looks up, what did I say? Some young student, you see. And he was saying this, and then he explained what he was trying to say. And Müller would say, well, that's what I was trying to say. But he had grasped the point, and then he said, well, this is a point, this is an objection that really has to be faced. And then we take the objection a little bit further. Then he would give it more deeper foundation, and then he said, now we have to address that question, yeah? And it's open to you. So in that sense, you really felt you were being listened to and taken seriously. And then when the hour and a half was up, in the middle of the discussion, that was the end of it. We just went off. There was no attempt to put things together, to teach us anything. Later, writing about teaching and about education, he said it's the task of the teacher to be a type of midwife, in a sense, to allow the student to discover for himself what is the truth.
That was Father Vincent Tooney, one of the original founding members of the Ratzinger Summer School, speaking to Emma McCarthy. Somalis are continuing to flee from their homeland as the worst drought and famine in the Horn of Africa region for decades bites harder. The disaster has already killed tens of thousands of people, especially children. The UN says about 12 million people need emergency food across the so-called Triangle of Death region, straddling Somalia, Kenya and Ethiopia. But what are the underlying reasons for this tragedy? And could we see a similar famine in the future, unless more effort is put into finding long-term solutions to food and water insecurity in the region? And what kind of life are the Somali refugees living in the camps of eastern Kenya? To find out more, I spoke to two members of the Caritas Internationalis Confederation, who have both recently returned from the Horn of Africa area. Laura Sheehan visited the huge Dadaab refugee camp in eastern Kenya earlier this month, where hundreds of Somali refugees fleeing the famine and conflict in their homeland arrive each day. She spoke to me about her impressions and what conditions are really like for these new arrivals.
The refugee camps near the Somali border are very crowded at this point. There's just a huge, huge influx of people who have walked for miles, often for weeks or even months, to escape Somalia, both because of the drought and famine, but also because of violence there.
And what were the condition of these people?
As they walked from Somalia to Kenya, the people faced incredible hardships. Just the heat alone and having no food and very little access to water is hard enough. They also faced lions and hyenas in some cases, attacks by wild animals that they would have to throw stones at. And then finally, there were many attacks by armed bandits who would steal what little they had, sometimes steal all their clothing, including the clothing they were wearing, and sometimes attack the women.
Now, what were conditions like then for these latest arrivals at the camp? I mean, what sort of shelter did they have? What sort of food were they getting?
What was happening was that the refugee camps, which have been there for many years, are now overflowing. There's simply no room in the regular areas for the new arrivals. So they're setting up makeshift shelters, usually just a bunch of sticks in a shape like a dome that they cover with scraps of cloth or plastic bags. And a lot of them are still even sleeping outside in the outskirts of the refugee camps.
And it's very hot and dusty there, right?
It's extremely hot and dusty near the border with Somalia. Just very difficult, even just to walk for water. They don't have to walk too far once they reach the refugee camps because there are water sources there, but it's very hot.
And what kind of food are they eating?
Somalis are accustomed to the diet of people who herd animals for a living. They're used to milk and a certain amount of meat now and then, and they also eat rice. When they come to the refugee camps in Dadaab, what they're getting is food from the World Food Program that tends to be wheat flour. Obviously, they're extremely grateful for food. A lot of them are on the border of starvation. But the wheat flour, they're not quite used to, and it makes them a little sick as their systems start to get used to it.
What do the people themselves say when you went around and talked to them?
The people who have just arrived from Somalia seemed completely exhausted, disoriented. I heard so many stories about the attacks they faced as they walked. And then, of course, going to the hospitals and seeing the malnourished children was very disturbing. The children were just so weak. Usually children sort of look at you with curiosity or even mischief. These children just had no energy. So some of them who were able to actually eat food were being given emergency rations, and then the ones who were too weak to even sort of chew and swallow were hooked up to IVs.
Were there many deaths occurring? What did you gather?
My impression was that if the people made it to the refugee camps, usually they could be stabilized, and there weren't many deaths in the camps themselves. I don't have information about how many died on the way.
But did you gather from talking to the people, from some of the parents, the mothers, that some of their the weaker children did die en route, presumably?
One woman I talked to, her son was unfortunately shot by armed bandits. He was 4 years old. He was trying to protect the family's goats.
And when you talked to that mother, what was she saying about it all?
She just seemed almost a little disoriented, just sort of in a state of shock. She was just trying to get by to try to understand how to live in the refugee camps. The camps are new to these people. They don't know how to do things. Everyone is very concerned about the process to get a ration card, to get food. So I feel that maybe she hadn't necessarily even been able to grieve because she was just fleeing for her life with her remaining children.
Now, have you been to other refugee situations? I mean, how did what you saw at Dadaab compare with previous experiences? I mean, was it quite disturbing or upsetting for you?
I've seen a lot of refugee situations, often because of war or natural disasters. I've never seen hunger on such a massive scale before, a famine that affects tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people at this point. I've never seen one so large.
When you talk to people there, did they feel that the crisis had not peaked, that, you know, there were going to be more deaths? What were people saying there when you talked to the people, say, at the hospital, for instance?
My impression was that people are not going to go back to Somalia, and people are still flooding out of there. Again, not only because of drought and hunger, but also because of the violence and insecurity of the situation. So there was a sense that this will just keep on going for a while, and a sense of people just not knowing what they'll do in the future and planning basically to stay for a while at the camp.
And how would you describe the role that was being played by Caritas and Catholic Relief Services and other humanitarian agencies of the Catholic Church?
There are a lot of humanitarian aid agencies there. Catholic and other groups are working very hard to help this huge influx of refugees. Normally, because the camps have been there for a while, there are structures set up there. There's water being trucked in. There are tents filled with a lot of bags of food. But it's just so many people that it's overwhelming. So I think that it's wonderful that Catholic agencies are really pouring in there and trying to help as much as they can, because it's just a massive problem.
And do you think it's going to get worse before it gets better?
It's hard to say whether it will get worse before it gets better. It does partly depend on the rains. If it rains and the water really soaks in and grazing land improves, then the animal herders will be able to stay in some regions of Somalia. So a lot of it is about the weather.
I was speaking to Laura Sheehan, who recently returned from the Dadaab camp in Kenya, where she went on behalf of Catholic Relief Services. Drought and changing weather patterns are one of the root causes of the famine. Alistair Dutton is the Emergency Programme Manager for Caritas Internationalis and recently returned from a tour of Kenya and Ethiopia. He speaks about what he saw and the complex underlying reasons for the drought.
It's definitely very severe this year. Down in the south, in the Berenar area of Ethiopia, pastoralists have had a very severe time coming into the summer, and there are animal carcasses lying on the ground where the animals, as people have been trying to move them to either water or pasture, the animals have just given up and lain down and died. And there are many, many of those carcasses, which is an indication of how severe it has been for people. On one occasion out in East Ethiopia, I drove into a village and there were about 40 men under one tree and I'd say 20 or so women under the tree beside it. They said, "We've come together to pray for rain. We're so concerned about the situation that this is what we do as a clan. We come together this way." And so they were there praying that rain would come this year. Strangely, they thought I was the answer to their prayers when we drove in a nice white Land Cruiser, and they thought we could somehow resolve the water problem. And it was water that they were first and foremost concerned about. Food is definitely a concern, but people can forage for food and they reduce the number of meals, but obviously water and dehydration kill people a lot quicker than lack of food. People are also moving, animal herders are moving much further than they normally do to try and find pasture and water, and they're moving into areas where they haven't previously gone, which in itself gives rise to tension which can flare up into conflict. And when I was in Kenya, we went into another village, and the village itself wouldn't normally have a problem even in the worst areas. But Somali pastoralists, that is ethnic Somalis from the Somali area of Kenya, had moved into this area, which was a farming area, and had forcibly stolen their grain reserves. So people who even had reserves were now coming under attack as people desperate for food were starting to adopt very unusual measures to try to survive the summer.
We saw a famine fundraiser summit last week by the African Union, but the pledges fell short, perhaps, of what many might have hoped. Why is that? Is there a donor fatigue over this crisis?
It's a good question. There may be an element of fatigue. There's also an element, I think, that the proposals as written tackle the problem from a number of areas, from a number of directions, some of which are immediate relief in terms of food aid or water, and those sectors tend to be fairly well funded. As we get more into elements of prevention, so trying to make people less susceptible to future droughts, that area of work can be much more difficult to achieve to get funding for. And so without having the figures in front of me, I would imagine that if we look at the funding patterns, it's not across the board. Some sectors will be relatively well funded, others will be less so. And interestingly, if I'm taking a longer term view, I would say the sectors that are more important longer term are the ones that it's harder to get funding for.
Because it's easier to get money for kids with swollen bellies, but it's not so easy or so simple to get money for, as you say, these long-term solutions, helping these people to be able to feed themselves or to be able to better withstand droughts. Is that the situation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you see pictures on the television of children with either distended bellies or parents holding children who are obviously very weak and at death's door, people respond with great generosity and compassion and give a lot of money. But if we talk about some of the longer-term, more systemic issues, they don't attract the same human response, and also fall into some of the longer term fatigue around development problems for the continent as a whole. So it's much less acute and people can't see quite how their money is making a difference in practical terms.
I mean, given, as you say, this fact of how the international community tends to respond to these situations, do you fear that we could see a similar crisis, a similar famine in the future, unless, as you say, there's more effort put into, you know, focusing on long-term solutions to help these people feed themselves better?
Quite definitely, and that's true across that sub-Saharan belt of Africa that runs from Mauritania in the west through to Somalia and Djibouti in the east. There will certainly be future droughts. The climate across that belt is becoming more erratic, more hostile, and people are having to deal with very unfamiliar weather patterns. The real tragedy this year is that enough rain has fallen, but it's fallen in very short periods of time and it's just run straight off the land, in many cases washing fertile topsoil with it, and it's flowed straight down the rivers and out into the ocean. So long-term investment is needed in agriculture and in water management to ensure that we catch that water, we use it to fill ponds, reservoirs, dams, to replenish the underground water, the aquifers. And if we do that, then people will have water all year round. It's also the case that because of the erratic climate, the soil is becoming less and less fertile every year. Now, there are many measures that can be taken to ensure that we make that soil more fertile in the future, but that requires long-term investment as well. So the tragedy isn't the lack of rain. The tragedy is we're not managing it properly. We know how to do that. What it needs is long-term investment, both in terms of money, but also in terms of know-how and actual organisation to make sure that we put that in place.
Coming back to the people, what do the people themselves say about their plight? What's their mood like?
Well, there's an element of fatalism, I think, which is we are at the mercy of the seasons and the climate. And I think that's one of the changes that are needed, that we help people see the opportunities to manage the resources they have better rather than just
shrugging
their shoulders and relying on the rain that fell today. And if rain doesn't fall for successive days in a week, then that can damage an entire harvest. So there are things they can do, and we need to overcome that fatalism. It's clearly a very difficult year. They're clearly very worried and somewhat depressed that they're now facing the third or the fourth failure of rains, and you can see that in their mood. They're also dealing with the loss of, in some cases, loved ones as a result of this. But certainly they've lost animals, they've lost a lot of their assets, their savings or their capital. And that means that life is that much more difficult and that much more precarious. For those of us in the West, we have ways of saving our assets and we have insurance in case something happens. They don't have that, so they feel those losses much more acutely than I think we can imagine.
And what would be a typical meal? I mean, how many meals do they have a day, these people?
Normally, they'd have three meals a day. Now, many of them are saying that they've gone down to two or one meal a day, and some of them aren't eating every day. They tend to prioritise the children, so the children eat better. The adults fare less well, and I'm afraid the elderly often are the ones who make the sacrifice and eat less than anybody else. Their meals are very, very basic. It's a kind of porridge made from maize meal often in this region, or it can be from teff or sorghum, but it's a porridge which turns into a kind of dough. And then they will eat that with some kind of sauce. By choice, it would be some kind of meat sauce. But as food becomes scarcer, very often it's foraging for leaves, and it's just leaves boiled in water to have some kind of flavour for what is otherwise a very bland staple carbohydrate.
I was speaking to Alistair Dutton, Emergency Programme Manager for Caritas Internationalis, about his visit to the Horn of Africa region. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.